Well, God in heaven, thank you again for this Lord's Day. Thank you again for the privilege and opportunity of coming together with your people to worship you. And Father, we pray in this hour that your Spirit would come and teach us, instruct us. Father, not with knowledge in our heads, but reforming our hearts to your image. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, good morning, and today we're here on the pathway. It's always shocking to me how quickly, as I start watching these numbers and get down toward the bottom of the list. But today, for the next 2 weeks, I remember I told you at the beginning, we probably were going to be a little bit uncomfortable sometimes. So this week and next week are the uncomfortable days, right? So I ask you to bear with me as we go through these. I will tell you, I told you to begin with, for the last 5 years, I've been reading a lot of books on both sides of all these issues. And I will tell you, they make me uncomfortable. They made me uncomfortable as I read them. I had to continue to hold the book because I just wanted to throw it or put it down and say, okay, I'm done with this. I'm not reading that. So today what I want to do is, like I said, just talk about racism, and in particular, racism against blacks today. I mean, predominantly racism is an issue across the board with Asians, with Native Americans, with black Americans, you know, but really historically what I'm focusing on is the whole really institution of slavery and what the vestiges of the institutions of slavery were and are and what that means to us today. All right? So, yes, sir. I think I do. We'll talk about it right here.
If you're getting there, that's right.
Yeah. At the very beginning, I actually started with the definition of racism, and basically talking about the categorization of people by race, and basically then a inferior superiority measurement that goes with that, and then access to things within the culture and society as a result of those categorizations. Okay, I think I paraphrased really what we talked about at the definition up front. Remember, these were the objectives that I showed you at the very beginning, and I made it red because that's what we're doing today. We're talking about the understanding of the historical and current issues generating racial tensions in our society. Okay, you and I are seeing and hearing swirlings and things going on out there. These are some of the foundation and basis. What I'm trying to do today historically, if I had some of the historians, I don't have all the historians in the room today, but if I had some of them, I'm not here to talk about the nuances about why we fought the Civil War, we didn't fight the Civil War. The point of it is we did. Why we had slavery or didn't and all the nuance, I'm not trying to argue for any of that. What I want you to see as we go through here today, if you get nothing else but this out of it, these were human beings that this has been done to, and what the impact and effect of having done that to human beings is on a culture and a society. That's all I'm after. Not here to argue about whether that historically should have happened or should not have happened or any of the rest of that. I threw a couple of these peacemaker passages out here. You and I are called by Jesus to be ministers of reconciliation with God, but with each other, and to be peacemakers in our culture and society. And to be part of that solution, to be part of that ministers of reconciliation, you and I have to listen to stuff we don't like. We have to listen to arguments we don't like, right? If we're ever going to come to the middle. One of the things as we move on in this class, one of the things I'm going to do, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit today, but I'm going to show you the two different approaches to having this conversation and solving this conversation. And I will tell you that some of the approach is, you white guys caused all this, sit down and shut up, you have nothing more to say. And slide all your stuff across the table because it's ours now, right? That's an approach. There's another approach that says, this stuff really didn't. You're exaggerating. This didn't really. It's kind of like the Holocaust deniers, right? This didn't happen, or it's not as bad as you say, right? There's those that say, hey, and before I read all these books, I would have told you this. I'm colorblind. I don't see color, right? I just judge you based on what you do or don't do. And I will tell you that approach doesn't work either. It's approach coming together between. In the middle of those two, that we're able to have this conversation. But in order to do that, we have to understand what is the foundation and basis of the people that are saying some of the things we don't like. And that's what I'm trying to do for us here today. Last week, I had three slides that said the history of race is a construct. In other words, throughout time, while we started saying people that look different are could potentially be parts of different races, right? And we started in the 16th, 17th century with basically what's called scientific or biological racism. And that's where you can begin to categorize people based on what their hair is like, their skin color is, what their habits are, what their dispositions are, whether and all that stuff. By the 18th century, the thought, okay, if we've got all these different boxes that we've built, are these actually subgroups of humanity? In other words, are these subgroups of man? Now, remember, you and I realize that all men are descended from one, right? Well, by the 19th century, one of the things I said in the 18th century there is the values assigned. When you start categorizing these qualities and those qualities, it was inevitable that you begin to attributing value to those qualities. These values are superior to those qualities. These values are inferior to these other qualities. And that started happening. Darwinism now gave you the mechanism by which to say, you know what? I think all these races aren't different species. Darwin was a monogenist. I can't even say the word, but we all came from one man. Darwin believed that. There's people that believe that the human race descended from multiple men in the Enlightenment. But he said, no, we all came from one. But his theories gave the ability to say, but I think these different categories of people we see are different steps on the evolutionary path of man. So that's what happened. The 20th century blew all this up, okay? When the world saw what Nazism did with these ideas and the kind of beliefs and then the actions of those, that everybody, this is untenable. And then genetics, by the late 1800s and into the 20th century, we now understood the genetics much better, which again put to bed any idea that man is different species. And back to kind of Gary's question a moment ago, so the belief was that because of these biological differences, we have these different levels and categories of good inferiority and superiority. And that, in a sense, it was the basis for a lot of the racist views and ideas. Now, there are some people that say that this was all done on purpose to allow the actions that were taken. I think it's much more innocent than that. I think the actions were taken, and these were ideas that people then later had, in some senses, maybe to justify some of the things that are being done. We're going to talk about slavery today. One of the things I've told you before, I see three analogies in history. Okay, I see the slavery, I see the Holocaust, I see abortion, and all three of them start at the same place. You have to first dehumanize the person to be able to do the kind of things to them you're going to go do. Before we dive in deep, I want to take a step back and take a deep breath, and I just want to think about just some philosophy of history things here, right? First of all, in history, the conquerors always considered themselves superior to those that they conquered. Whether they were or not, when the Romans went out and conquered the barbarians, who could even understand that gibberish, whatever these guys are saying? Look how much more superior our culture is to yours. And oh, by the way, if we weren't a better culture than you, we wouldn't have been able to defeat you. Right? One of the things that's fascinating, I don't know if you've ever read about Cortez taking Mexico City or whatever, that word too. Okay? If you go read about that, there is no way on God's green earth the Spaniards should have ever been able to have pulled that off. They had even superior military power that they could have overwhelmed them had they done it, right? The Europeans didn't conquer them because they were superior in that sense. They conquered them because of a lot of different things. One of them was the fact that the Aztecs were such racist that they had all these people that they continually went and culled through your neighborhood and brought you in to make you the sacrifice, right? So what he really found there when he got there was the fact that I got all of these people that are willing to help me get rid of those guys. But anyway, conquerors always consider my culture superior to your culture. European imperial impulse. From the time we started going out, discovering the new world, and then going and building markets and things, there was a sense of superiority. We're superior to these people. Look, they're not even hardly wearing clothes. Look at what we got, right? So that was there, but also a paternalism. And that paternalism is a thread that we're going to see throughout a lot of this idea of racism, is the fact that these people of color are like little children that need a mom and dad. They're incapable of governing themselves. This is a lot of what happened in Africa, right? Whenever the Europeans finally started going in and out of the goodness of their heart, wanting to take care of these people. Oh, by the way, look at all these resources here. This is incredible. This is amazing. But That's why I put in this little box over here. You and I should always have a healthy dose of suspicion of our own motives, and the more altruistic they seem to be, the more suspicious you and I should be of why we're trying to do what we do. That one's for free. At the expense of freedom and expense of those dominated. So when the Europeans came and started dominating the Indians, being them in the Caribbean, being them on the American continent, North American continent, whatever, again, at great loss of freedom, and then over time of esteem, Howard Thurman wrote a book, Jesus and the Disenfranchised. And what he was, I told you, he was a guy that was a predator. Martin Luther King got a lot of his philosophies and ideas from, because he was about 10 or 20 years before Martin Luther King Jr. And his thing continuously, because he was trying to deal with what is the psychology of a people that's been subordinated like this? What happens to them? And he was trying to, with the gospel, help them and fix them and change them. Quit looking at yourself as a victim. Do not ever let someone else make you hate them. That kind of message, which was Martin Luther King Jr.'s message as well. So, but this conquering people comes at a great expense to those who are conquered. Two historical perspectives you and I must navigate between. Failure on the one side to acknowledge the sovereignty of God in history, right? If you're a Southern sympathizer, you still at the end of the day have to say, you know what, for whatever reason, God in his providence did not let the South win the war. The North won the war. So we need to, as we march on in history, acknowledge that and try to understand why and be part of what God is doing moving forward. I will tell you that as we're going to look at the different sides of this conversation, the one side is not willing to give God any credit at all for his providence in history, for things being the way they are today moving forward. Also, but presumption on the other side, that if God let that happen, then it's okay. In other words, justifying everything that comes after that. If God allowed us to subjugate these people in history, then whatever we do to them is okay. Right? That, and we need to navigate between those two failures. The worst you can say about us, I want to defend us here for a minute, okay? The worst you can say about the United States of America, about us, and what happened racially here, is number one, everybody else was doing it. We didn't do anything anybody else wasn't doing, right? This was part of the world at that time. Now, we hold ourselves to a higher standard than that. And, oh, by the way, one of the reasons you're hearing all the dust up is if you're going to be a city sit on a hill and you're all these other things you claim to be, then we're going to hold you to a higher standard than that. I mean, quite honestly, think about it. Why aren't people looking around the world at all these other places that have done all that and are doing all this stuff and bringing the same level of criticism against them that they do us? They don't, right? That's why I find it crazy when I hear progressives against conservatives talking about a conservative view toward women, but yet they're defending Muslims in the Middle East for things that they're doing, and you can't get any worse to women than they are, right? Those kind of disconnects in history. And if our detractors were honest, that we admit that we have not been as bad as most of the others. Here's the guiding principles you and I talked about that we're going to kind of use. We take the lens and look at these historical events and what's happened. Every person deserves a degree of dignity and respect as bearers of the image of God. This never lose sight of this as we go through this and think about what has happened to people. Think about the things that we did to human beings created in the image of God. All men have descended from one father, Adam. Old creation distinctions are gone. Now there's nothing but believers and unbelievers. And then you and I must compare our motives and actions with the command to love our neighbors ourselves. All right, so those are thoughts you and I are trying to keep in the back of our mind as we look at these events and things that have happened. I'm going to lay out two projects to you, the 1619 project and then the 1776 Unite. So how many of you have heard of the 1619 project? Most of you, I'm sure. Series of essays chartered and published by the New York Times. There's a wide it goes that be in the 2019 as an alternative view of American history. The actual their declaration is the actual founding of America started in 1619, not 1620 when the Pilgrims hit Plymouth Rock. And why 1619? What happened in 1619? A pirate ship had actually captured 20 African Americans, and they came to Jamestown to get food, and they traded them 20 African Americans for food. So the 1619 Project declares that was the beginning of slavery in America when these 20 African Americans. These 20 African Americans were not slaves. They were treated as indentured servants. In other words, Jamestown guys took them. They worked them for a period of years, and just like any other white indentured servant, let them go at the end of that. So that's kind of a not true. But the whole premise is that America is essentially and irrevocably, irrefixably rooted in injustice and racism. And if there is really nothing to be done for it but to break it, to destroy it, to turn it upside down. Slavery defines the true character of America, oppressive and racist to the core, focuses on the moral failings, totally ignoring any moral triumphs. And the author, Nicole Hannah Jones, when confronted, even many secular historians have criticized and said, hey, these things never happened. You've distorted the history terribly. Her answer to that is, well, this isn't really a work of history, but a work of memory. A work of memory, right? How do you even deal with that? I mean, what do you even do with that? And this kind of gets back, if you will remember, and we're gonna get to critical race theory in a little bit, not today. And if you'll remember, we went through the rise and triumph of the modern self or the strange new world in Sunday school. This is the whole idea of subjective versus objective. It happened because we feel like it happened. And if I felt like it happened, it happened, right? How do you even deal with that, right? Some of you husbands and wives may be wondering about that. How do you even, no.
You feel too much.
What's that?
You feel too much.
Yeah. What's that got to do with it? Yeah. The ultimate goal of 1619th Project is to drive the basically reparations arguments and basically a radical overturning of American society. All this stuff that we're going to talk about really is Marxism, right? It's the fact that capitalism and free enterprise is a terrible thing. It's resulted in all this stuff. In fact, capitalism was actually invented for the whole purpose of justifying slavery. I mean, they say things like that. Anyway, one of the quotes about it is, this is not a different interpretation of history. It is an outright misrepresentation of history. Okay. Yes, sir.
Is it unique in American slavery that the black man was considered not to have a soul?
Well, so next week we're going to get into talking about what the church said about some of these things. Yes, there were some people that said that, right? And again, like I said, I'm not trying to, as a 21st century American man, look back and judge these people that were born in a period of time. Can you imagine all of a sudden people show up that look radically different than you? We can't even communicate with each other. There were questions about, are these human beings or are these some other level of, right? You know, those are some of the arguments we talked about in the historical construct of race. Right, but those kind of conversations did go on. Eventually, these are people. You know, I always go back to kind producing kind. Quite honestly, any two things that can reproduce together are the same seed, right? So, in response to the 1619 Project, a group of black authors got together and put together a thing called Unite, 1776 Unite. They wrote a book called Red, Yellow, and White. I highly recommend, Red, Yellow. Red, White, and Black. Goodness. How those all come out together, I have no idea. Red, White, and Black is the name of the book that they wrote, and it's a series of essays all by all black authors, and it's incredibly inspiring. I highly recommend that you read it. Here's what they say. Because, first of all, some of their underpinnings were this. Well, let me read what they said, and then I'll tell you what some of the reasons they were motivated to do this. America is good at its core. Its founding principles and documents are aspirational. I'm kind of 10 pounds in a 5-pound bag today anyway, so I was actually going to show you Frederick Douglass and some of his quotes. Frederick Douglass was incredibly committed to the Constitution of the United States and the aspirational values and beliefs of America. He was calling them to be faithful and true to those. Martin Luther King Jr. was a very believed in America and believed in the founding principles. He was just calling America to be faithful to those. Anyway, America is good to its core. Its founding principles and aspirational failure of all men, even the authors of these documents, speaks to their frailty and failure, not to their principles. The founding principles have actually provided us the ability to heal and fix problems. That's something that I wish everybody, even on both sides, would give us credit for. We have a system in place that allows us to fix these things. They were bad. They were wrong. We have fixed them. We are fixing them, and we will fix them, right? We're going to get better as time goes on. The fact that we have been able to embrace the principles of the American founding, despite the hypocrisy with which these principles were first applied to us, should testify to their power, not justify their weakening or destruction. These people were so concerned, they said, listen, you are not helping the black community by telling them they're victims and the doctrine of victimhood. You're not helping our young kids when you tell them that hard work and perseverance and virtue and character matter, right? So that's one of the things I hate hearing. I listen to the emotional or the generational debates that go on around us, right? The boomers, the bad guys versus, you know, these other guys. You are never ever going to be able to succeed because these guys screwed this up so bad. You're never going to be able to have a house. You're never going to be able to, you know, to live the American dream. You're never going to be able to retire. You're never going to be able, right? Okay, Caleb, you got a house?
I do.
Okay. I know many, many people in the categories that these people are arguing about that, quite honestly, well, if that's true, how come? Why, right? But that's an excellent excuse for your humanity, for your laziness, right? For your fallen laziness. That's why, and these guys, when you tell people that, if you, it doesn't matter how hard you work, you can never get ahead because a man's got his foot on your throat, right? That takes away every bit of incentive to work hard. So this, if you read Red, White, and Black, it is full of just one story after another. And what it does is it chronicles the success, historical success of black Americans, people who achieved things, people who became entrepreneurs, people talking about their educational rates. And quite honestly, as we go through this course, one of the things we're going to find is until the 1960s, the black community was on a tremendous trajectory from where they were to where they were going and were successful and were succeeding. Even, I told you this at the beginning, not one of the authors that I read denied racism and discrimination as a very real part of American society. But what they refused to do, as opposed to the 1619 Project, is to allow that to be used for any failures in the black community. So one of the things I'm going to do is we're going to talk about what the social justice says, and then we're going to look at the Thomas Sowell and other people like him to give us the facts, figures, and numbers that show, well, that's not true, right? You're drawing a false conclusion. He would tell you that racism and prejudice and discrimination in America is a very real thing. What he was going to say is, but all the excuses you're wanting to offer for why we're failing over here aren't attributable to that. So that's who these guys are. And it's an extremely, I've told you this before, if you've ever read Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery, and then I'd recommend adding this Red, White, and Black to your list with those to actually get a good picture of people who, again, are trying to lay a solid foundation for a black community to go forward. Here's a very brief history of slavery, and then we're going to talk about slavery in America, okay? Slavery has always existed from the beginning of time, okay? Always. The ones that were stronger would overpower and take advantage of the ones that were weaker. And hey, you can come over here and work for me for free. This is great. I like this, right? That's been here since the beginning of time. Slave trade has always existed in Africa. One of the things, like I just told you about the liberals and the Muslims, it blows my mind that people that are trying to be so accusatory of whites in history are not looking and going, first of all, we didn't invent this, right? And in fact, when we picked them up, we went to the shore and picked them up. Because your slave traders who had been operating for millennia would bring them to the shore and sell them to us. So that's just a historical artifact. But what happened in America was the perceived. I actually changed that word this morning to perceived. It said, because the author that I read said the need for, now the perceived need for free labor in European colonies, Caribbean, South America, and North America, led to this, the transatlantic slave trade. Okay? We got all this stuff. We got all these cash crops we're beginning to grow. We're tobacco. And to be honest with you, tobacco was the big deal until the cotton. We had cotton, but not that much cotton until the cotton gin. And then all of a sudden, we turned all those tobacco fields into cotton fields. And we need help. We need people to work for us. One of the things that's interesting, I'll draw a Caribbean, South America, North America. First of all, slavery in South America and the Caribbean were brutal. Okay? When they got a slave, they bought them. Worked them till they died, went and bought another one, okay? They didn't feed them. They didn't clothe them, okay? It was the responsibility of those slaves to take care of themselves with a little bit of time they had left, all right? That's the way it was in Brazil and South America. In America, we're going to see in a minute, in 1808, the slave trade was cut off. In other words, it was no longer legal after 1808 to bring slaves here in a boat. I said it's no longer legal. I'm not saying it never happened, but it was no longer legal. Right. So America always viewed their slaves as like I got a good horse, right? I'm going to take care of that horse. I'm going to last as long as possible. I'm going to feed it. I'm not going to work it to death. In those other places, they just worked them to death. The result, Thomas Sowell, I don't think any of you have ever read, it's a chapter out of his PhD thesis, and he talks about the success of black Americans based upon where their forefathers came from, whether they came from the Caribbean, whether they came from South America, whether they came from southern slavery. The people in America were two generations behind economically once they were free. Because the ones in the Caribbean, the ones in South America, and the ones in Louisiana, by the way. I don't know if you, Louis, that's one thing that museum lecture that Mickey and Judy and I, Barbara got when we were in New Orleans, talked about how the Louisiana was always under the Justinian law system, right? Which under Justinian law system, the slave always got one day a week that was his own. Do anything he wanted to him that one day a week. So what they'd do is they'd go sell themselves off to somebody. They'd work, get money, and then they could buy their own freedom. The result of that was the ones from the Caribbean, the ones from Louisiana, whenever they were emancipated, were much light years ahead of the slaves in the South in being able to take care of themselves. Part of the plantation system was to make that slave so dependent on you. You think about it, they got guys riding out there on horses with guns, right, looking for what they did. There were so few that even tried to get away, right, because they were so radically, totally dependent. They didn't have to feed themselves. They didn't have to take care of themselves other than what the plantation owner did for them. So that was a difference. I always found that was an interesting artifact of the difference in their success given where they came from. You guys all learned this in school, right? The European, the Portugal, Spain, Britain, these different European countries would go down to Africa and sell them manufactured goods, rum, and then get the slaves. Take the slaves to the Caribbean, some of the North American colonies, and while they were in the Caribbean, they sold slaves for sometimes the unprocessed sugar, and then another's rum itself, right? And then would take that to the Northeast, and up in the Northeast, they would get all these trade the things that they had for manufactured goods, as well as slaves, and then get back on the boat and go back. So that was the triangle. Okay, you can read history. There's all different kinds between 16th and 18th century. Most of the guys have settled around 12 and a half million people that were actually transported across here from Africa. Brazil was the largest recipient. The Caribbean next. And in the United States, about four million people. About 2 million people did not survive the ride. Okay, so you want to get sick at your stomach? You go down and look what we did to human beings here. Okay, these slave ships, you actually built. You just chained them up and laid them down in these berths, and they laid there. They laid in their own filth. They almost starved to death. Many did starve to death. But they died from starvation, from scurvy, from dysentery. About two million died that way. Again, horrible, horrible. That any, this is just the fallenness of man, but that any human being could ever do that to another human being. Okay, we did this. changing of nature of slave trade, labor in colonial America. So from the beginning of the 1600s to the late 1600s, we kind of went from most depending on indentured servitude, and then started transitioning to slave labor. Now, we still had indentured servitude after this period, but the point of it is now when we introduce the slave labor. So slavery was legal in all the colonies. Slavery was, and we're going to look at the distinction between biblical slavery and this slavery, but it was reserved for the people of African descent. There's a caveat here. Actually, we started off with the Native Americans. But to be honest with you, we wiped out so much of the Native American population with our diseases. In other words, things that they had no inoculation for, and so many of them died, we needed another source, and that is what drove us to the African slave trade. Enslavement was for life, whereas indentured servant, that was for a period of time, it's contractual. And then before that, the indentured, there wasn't that big a distinction between an indentured a black indentured servant and a white indentured servant. But now all of a sudden we made those distinctions, and it actually became illegal for these people to start hanging out with those people. So, all right. Transatlantic slave trade, again, because of the need for all these work for cash crops, was outlawed in 1808, but the domestic slave trade did not. I mean, it continued to go on. You could continue to have them, domestic slave trade still flourished. By 1860, one half of the South were African Americans, were slaves. Okay. Now, here's where we start. That was a huge problem. Okay. The Southerners were terrified. You know, you got the Nat Turner Rebellion, and you had two or three other slave revolts where they uprise. And at South, the Southerners were continuously terrified of this. The Southerners really would have liked, when got to watch the broad brushes here, okay? Everybody wasn't for slavery, and everybody wasn't against it. But there were a lot of sentiment in the South that this is not a good idea. We need to stop this. But how? If we just let these people go, they can't read and write. They have no skills other than farming. How do they take care of themselves? And what if they all get together and come and kill us? Because God knows we probably deserve it, right? That was the sentiment in the South, and that was the problem with half your population was this. I didn't touch on it later. So you all familiar with the Three-Fifths Compromise, right? You've heard that term before. And it's interesting because, see, we consider a black person only three-fifths of a white person. This was a political football, right? The North, or the South, you had to pay taxes based on how many people you had. And the South didn't want to have to pay taxes on all these. So how about three-fifths? And the North said, if we let them count those as real people, then they get more representation in Congress, and we'll never get anything done here. They'll win every time, right? So that's what the Three-Fifths Compromise was about, was between the North and the South agreeing, okay, for counting noses, for the purposes of political representation, we're going to make sure. You'll hear people talk about that was a, it had nothing to do with us thinking that a black person was only the value of three-fifths of a white person. Yes, sir. Sentiment on both sides of the water about slavery. All right. Here are the living conditions. So we're on plantation. Now listen, again, I know if I had Southern advocates in here, everybody wasn't like this. We treated them like children. They loved being part of the family, etc., etc. Okay. I'm not denying that there weren't aspects of times that were true. But I will tell you wholeheartedly, one of the things in the last 100 years is they finally got the slave journals, right? And they were able to get and to digitize and to look at. So the story that you get and the way they really felt and what was really going on are two different pictures, right? So again, I'm not denying that paternalism. I am denying that as a race, these people never, ever wanted to be incarcerated, wanted to be enslaved. Living conditions, system created total dependence on the owner. We already talked about that. Prohibited, it was illegal to try to teach blacks to read and write. Restricted from gathering. And the only time we'd allow you together is when we had our guy there. And our guy generally, a lot of times, was your minister, who we make sure we vetted and we make sure that he's telling you the right things and not the wrong things. Rebellion was brutally punished. I could have brought you pictures in here. It showed you the backs of slaves. White owners raped enslaved women with impunity. Okay. There was a strict hierarchy even among the workers. So the ones that were most compliant, so the more compliant you were, the better gig you got on the plantation. So living in the house was a good deal. Right? So you have the house workers. You had the skilled artisans, the guys that were blacksmiths and could do other things, very, very valuable. And then you got the guy that's a field hand out there. And any guy, any person that showed any intelligence or gumption, in other words, you're a field hand. You're going to the field out there. Marriage was encouraged but not legally recognized. One of the things that happened after the slaves were emancipated after the Civil War is many of the blacks went and asked to be remarried so that they could have a legal union because their marriages were not legally recognized. Interstate slave trade destroyed 25% of first marriages and actually broke 50% of nuclear families broke them up. In other words, I own you, I can do, I don't care if you and her are married, I don't care if you and her have children, I'm going to take your child and sell him, I'm going to take your wife, sell her, so this was just an aspect of what African chattel slavery was like. Now, next week, yes, sir.
I was going to go, I think in one of the first days you mentioned some people believe that slavery was generally good in America, which you hear slaves grow up and we see examples here. What would you say the percentage be like? Was it majority bad? I mean, there were cases of good and bad, but was it majority like this? Was it majority good?
I don't have a statistic to throw at you there. I will tell you the further. So if you lived in Kentucky, if you were a slave in Kentucky, the biggest threat that could ever be thrown at you is I'm selling you down the river. I'm selling you down the south. I'm going to send you down there where they really are. Okay? I don't know what the statistics are. The point of it is, even when they were treated well, I'm telling you, it's not, before God, we justify this, right? An institution that does this. All right. Yes, sir.
Maybe you've already covered this because I came in a couple minutes later.
I'm sure I did, but go ahead. No.
Leviticus, talking about slavery.
Right.
And it seems as if God
yes.
was okay with owning another people as a chattel.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts? Or Dr. Storr or Dr. Moses?
Now, what Doug just said is true.
Okay.
So God didn't step in. What Jim, if my buddy Jim Jordan were standing here before you today, what he would tell you is this already existed and it was brutal, it was horrible. What he was doing was he was giving, no, here's how godly people do this. Right? You and I would love to see 20th century, 21st American sinners. We're like, no. God should have said again, stop it, don't do it. Right? But what he did is he gave very definitive rules. Just like the devil said the same. The ark, he actually was giving more dignity to the same thing with women. When the guys like to look back at the things that it's like, well, what? If you see what it was like before he said that, in other words, he was actually giving them rights. In fact, these people had rights. These people, there are different reasons why people became slaves. Okay, you lost the war. You got caught stealing something and you can't restore it, so you're now going to be put in slavery. This is Hebrew slavery. Okay, you're in debt and you can't pay your debts. Right, but all those were always with a. Actually, let's say you got thrown in.
Well, when's the seventh year coming? Because in the seventh year I go free. Right.
Wasn't that only true for your
countrymen? Yes, 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 yes.
Right. So, but these are the differences. Slavery was never about one ethnic. Okay, we do Hittite chattel slavery. It wasn't like that at all, right? And none of the ancient world was it like that.
right? Until I told you, it was about the 7th century, the Muslims, using some Babylonian enthronement stuff, basically said, you know what? Blacks were intended to be the slaves of the world. So
across the entire Muslim world, they started using African slave trade to actually fill up the coffers there. But you weren't born into servitude here. You could legally marry and own property. And when you left, you got to take your depending on, there's rules for that, but you left with your wife and your kids, right? When you left, and your property. You worked a specific term, not a lifetime. Other than the term slavery, there's not much similarity between African chattel slavery and biblical slavery. Yes, sir. Right.
He comes in married, then his wife should go out with him. But then here's the one that I think might contradict your bullet up there on the prior chart. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master.
Correct. So that is correct. That is correct.
I don't deny that.
Okay.
Well, obviously, I don't deny it.
Yeah. Right. And he goes out alone, so the master gets to keep the woman and the children. So,
or he can choose to stay with that owner, to stay with his wife and children, and then they'll go down to the tent peg or the tent thing and put a hole in his ear.
Right. So I appreciate the balance that you're attempting to bring. But being 150 years, 200 years removed from what's going on in the United States,
right?
It really depends on who you read. Because I'm a Southern sympathizer, I like my guys, and they tell me it wasn't so bad. The other side says, man, it was terrible. They beat and killed and raped and pillaged.
And Gary, I'm not trying to get up and I know I've read all those books on both sides. My point is, so I'm giving you my opinion, right? Mm-hmm. This is wrong, period. It was wrong, period, for us to take these people on these ships, get them over here, and then treat them like this. Even if I treated that, just the whole idea that this is going on. Now, to Doug's question, quite honestly, probably here's what I should have said, and we could have got off this and gone on. And that is, there's no answer I'm ever going to give a progressive, liberal atheist that satisfies them about a God in the Bible that allows slavery to stand. Not going to happen. Right? There's a lot about that. To be honest with you, there's aspects of it I don't understand. And it's like a lot of the rest of the Bible I don't understand. I just have to say, you know what? I'm going to humbly submit my heart and mind to God and say, He's bigger than I am, and He's got reasons for doing what He did that I don't get. Right? But no, I'm never going to be able to come up with an argument that's going to convince somebody on the other side.
Yes, Caleb.
So we were talking about the ownership of slaves and how in the Hebrew slavery there was every 7th year you're set free. But when we read like Philemon, there's slavery there, and Paul doesn't say to Philemon, well, Onesimus is now your brother in Christ, you can't be your slave. And in Ephesians we have instructions to bondservants and to masters, and the instructions to the masters are not.
And in Corinthians, he says, if you're a slave, stay a slave. And free, stay free. Right? Now, Mike and I talked a little bit about Onesimus, Philemon, and Onesimus. First of all, what Paul's saying is he's sending him back because of the obligation. Okay? He's yours. He shouldn't have ran away. Now he's coming back as a brother, treating him as a brother. You know, by the way, if he owes you anything or anything's owed on his behalf, put it on my account. Because you owe me eating your life yourself, right? So, no, I can't, from an Old Testament, New Testament perspective, tell you why God didn't just have a verse that said, slavery's wrong, don't do it. He didn't do that, right?
All acknowledged. Yes, sir.
Speaks into his people's lives and the time and place in which they live in.
Right.
And the existence of slavery was a reality of the time and place that they lived in. And all these passages that we're talking about.
Right. Now, Mike, I 100% agree on that analogy. That analog.
To make that distinction between just because there's rules in the
right.
Bible speaking to it.
Right.
Okay. Does not mean that that is God's will.
Right.
For his people.
Amen. Right. It's a great analogy for that. So now, historically, I'm going to go through just to get us into you. I'm not going to get you done on time today, but you've asked questions. Shame on you. No. Reconstruction. So we're all aware. So really, between the end of the war, and people argue about when Reconstruction should start. Some say the Emancipation Proclamation. But from the end of the war to about 1877. And what ended it was that was when the last the Confederate states were brought back into the Union, and a military militia or the martial law was taken off the South. Okay, so that's 1877. This is a period where you're trying to okay, we've got these guys, we got these people, these treasonous rebels have tried to overthrow, tried to leave. We got them back. What do we do with them? How do we do this? How do we manage this? And again, I've always been personally sorry in the providence of God that Abraham Lincoln was killed, because if Abraham Lincoln had remained president, I do think Reconstruction would have gone a lot better, right? A lot of the issues we still deal with today swirl out of that trying to put this thing back together again, right? Legally, politically, socially, to reintegrate and to bring them back in. The big things that happened, the three constitutional amendments that happened during Reconstruction, okay? And what's interesting is the guys that were running the train here are guys called the Radical Republicans, right? And you and I look at them, well, they're Republicans and a radical. Be honest with you, these guys, it's almost like 100 years the perspectives have flipped. But these are the guys that were driving the train. 13th Amendment abolished slavery. The 14th Amendment guaranteed U.S. citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. and granting them federal rights. Right? I'm going to stop for a second because you see in the news today the 14th Amendment, right? This whole naturalized. And I'll be honest with you, I have always believed that birth citizenship is wrong. That was a misapplication, a misinterpretation of this 14th Amendment. I would like to see this get adjudicated, and I would like to see them quit doing this ignorance. We are incentivizing a lot of really bad behavior by people in other countries that are risking their lives just so if I can get my foot on here and then have my baby, this baby is automatically a natural a U.S. citizen. Insane. That is never what this amendment was intended to do. What this amendment was intended to do was to bring the emancipated slaves and give them citizenship, U.S. citizenship. And then if the 14th Amendment, the other part I didn't realize, and granting them federal civil rights. To be honest with you, we in prayer breakfast did the 10th Amendment, Archie's 10th Amendment book, right, in prayer breakfast one time. To be honest with you, the 14th Amendment took your whole Bill of Rights and turned it on its head. Okay? The Bill of Rights, the promises, all the things that are in there that were given to the states to say, we will not, you don't have to worry about us intruding in these areas. Oh, okay, good. I'll sign this thing then. What the 14th Amendment in essence does is takes the Bill of Rights and turns it on its head and now says the federal government has a responsibility to make sure every citizen in your state has access to these rights. Right? So it turned it on its head. And that's what we've lived with since then. And to be honest with you, you can get romantic and want to get, that ship sailed. That's not where we're at. We now have a 14th Amendment that says, and that's why you see the federal government doing all the things that they do to step in and to impose. And then the 15th Amendment gave the blacks the right to vote. Okay, so that was the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Other things, there's a lot of other details going on at this point in time. One of the first things they did is took away a lot of the property from the slaveholders and gave it to black people. So they were taken away from him. And then it wasn't long that slaveholders figured out how to get it back, and they did, legally. But a lot of the friction and the frustration that everybody has lived with comes out of this period, right? In the way, because now you have the North. Yeah, the war's over, but you got your soldiers down there with your neck on, your foot on our neck. So a lot of the hatred for, we got enough problems trying to get along with these people that we've enslaved anyway, and now you're coming down here and do that, and I really think it exasperated the hatred. Yes, Ken?
Was it mixed in there somewhere where you didn't have to have property anymore than you had to vote?
Mike?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I thought you were going to answer his question. You had already gotten rid of the having to have property to vote, right?
So my opinion of Reconstruction was flipped from being sort of a Southern partisan, you know, it was oppressive. If you read Ron Chernow's excellent biography of U.S. Grant, I came away from that section of the book saying I wish Reconstruction had lasted longer. Mm-hmm. The wicked illegality of, you know, you're a white man and you want to run as Republican in Louisiana, you're going to be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
You're a black man and you want to run as Republican in Louisiana, you're going to be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Just the vigilantism,
right,
and lawlessness was horrific.
Right.
So.
I wanted to just throw the KKK
and
out.
The radical Republicans hated Grant because they viewed him as a moderate.
Right. We're out of time, but I tell you, when I was in the seventh grade, the first time I ever heard the term Ku Klux Klan, never heard it before in my life. And we're in class, and the first day of geography class, Otis Lee Fansler went around and said, tell us something interesting about you that none of us knows. And this girl named Ruth Reinhardt sitting there, and she just said, like, just be me. And she goes, my daddy got a medal in the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, he kind of looked at her like, yeah, they said the explosive to go off on the bridge. It didn't go off, and he went back and relit it and blew the bridge up. He got a medal in the Ku Klux Klan.
First time I ever heard the words. There were three iterations of the Klan, right? One during this period of time, 1865, on to actually fight the Reconstruction. The fact the blacks were being were actually voting now, you're actually having black legislators, right? And they're actually helping to make the rules and the laws around here. We can't have that, right? So the Ku Klux Klan was the vigilante violence that Mike's talking about that was killing the people, not just the blacks, but their white sympathizers as well. And the second iteration was because of immigration in the 1915 started going, and again, it was a, I want to make sure I get the words right here, native-born white Protestants, okay? So we're against people of color. We're against immigrants. If you weren't born here, you don't belong here. And we're against anybody that's not a Protestant. So that was that period of time. And in the 1950s, it was born again in the fighting the civil rights movement. So very quickly move through that. But the great news is from the heyday of 3 to 6 million members, they have like 3 to 6,000 today. If you remember last time I really heard anything significant, I remember David Duke, Louisiana, who was the grand wizard of the KKK, was going to be. So we come out of Reconstruction, the North's gone now, and now we started making all these, now the Southerners began to make laws to get the control back, to again subjugate and keep black people in their place. Poll taxes and literacy tests, yeah, you got the right to vote, but you got to meet this before you can do that. And oh, by the way, if you were able to vote before 1867, you're grandfathered in. Convict leasing. If you ever got arrested for anything, and they would find the most minor thing to arrest you for, they put you in there, they would give you fines that there's no way that you could pay, and then what they would allow the local farmers and other people to come and to lease you, pay the prison a little bit of money and lease you. So just another form of slavery. Sharecropping, really another form of slavery. One of the laws they had was if you didn't have a contract in January, you're going to jail. And so every January I'd come and say, Mike, sign here. And you'd have to take whatever I offered, right? So these are means of actually keeping the free labor going. Terror, including lynching. Laws codifying separate cars. railroad cars. So you had a black car, and you had a, and then the whites would sit here, and the blacks had to sit here in the car. The whole Plessy versus Ferguson, right, in 1891, Louisiana made their rail car law. He actually went and tried to sit in the white car and said, "That's, you're taking away my 14th Amendment rights." It went there, and the judge in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. It was a failing to believe that the enforced separation of two races stamps the colored race with a badge of inferiority. Okay, that was 1896. And all these things that I've put below here are a result of that. We have different water fountains. We have different hotels. We have different restaurants. The white boys play on this field. You blacks need to go get you another field over there, because the white boys aren't playing a field the blacks played on. If these books had ever been used by a black kid, a white kid could never use those. Right? On and on and on and on. Mixed race marriages were outlawed, and it's incredible in a lot of states. It's just not that long ago that these rules of interracial marriage were taken away. Brown versus Board of Education. So Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown versus Board of Education are really the two goalposts here. 1896. In 1954, Otis Brown wanted his daughter to, is that his name, Homer? No, Oliver Brown. Oliver Brown wanted his daughter to go. Now, I should say, all these cases that you're going to see, Rosa Parks, this one, on and on, every one of these were setups. And what I mean by that is the NAACP went out and said, okay, we're going to challenge this. And so they actually started having people in Delaware and other places that would come in and file suits and, hey, my kids should be able to go to this white school down here. This is the one that stuck and made it, and made it through the courts. The Kansas State Department of Education said, nah, we're sticking with separate but equal. The Supreme Court, Earl Warren wrote the majority opinion. In the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place, as segregated schools are inherently unequal. As a result of the court rule, the plaintiffs were being deprived of equal protection laws guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment. So Brown versus Board of Education got rid of the separate but equal. It overturned really the results of the that prior problem. Here's some other things that happened. VA benefits were distributed unevenly to blacks and whites after the Second World War. Yes, sir.
I got to hear not Linda Brown, but one of Oliver Brown's daughters talked a couple of years ago. And her opinion is that American public education is worse for blacks after Brown v. Board than it was before.
Right. So yes, I mean, I've talked to people in Okaloosa County that when they began integration of schools, the black community was not for that. They felt like their children were better off being educated by their black teachers who cared about them, and by you now making me take them and send them to those other places. We're out of time today. I'll tell you what, I'll start next week here, right? Because I want to go through some of these other things because they have implications, right? They have meaning, and so when you hear people talking about these things, these are kind of like this real estate issue. So the point of it is, segregation still pretty much exists from a real estate perspective. It doesn't mean it totally, right? From a school perspective, from a lot of different perspectives, right? We figured out rules and laws and ways to get to do what we want to do, even in when we're supposed to be colorblind and all being fair and equitable. Yes. Next week. So what I'm going to do next week is go through what we did this week, but talk about what the church was doing and saying when that was going on. That's what the next week is. Summary. I believe that racism and discrimination and prejudice in American culture, you can argue about degree. You can argue about how much it matters. But I don't think when you look at our political and social traditions, rules, and laws, that you can argue that. Again, and I'll finish with that thought. Varying levels of impact on individuals and groups, there's a whole list of statistics that we can show, right? Now, what I'm going to do as we go forward is take a lot of these statistics, because the statistics are true. The implications being drawn from those. In other words, that this slavery and racism is the reason why all these statistics are the way they are. And they're not. There are other reasons. It's one variable, not all the variables. The arguments that swirl around you and I today as to who is to who to blame and what to do about it. All right? So that's, I'm trying to just make us at least knowledgeable enough about what the arguments are so that we can be part of this conversation. Right? I hope you agree with me that there is a very human element to this issue. These were human beings that were put on these boats. These were human beings that were treated the ways that many of these were. Even though some of them were treated good, a lot of them were treated really bad. This should make you and I, even I've told you this before, when we look at the border and what's going on at the border, there's a political argument there about a sovereign state being able to control its border. But there's also a very human argument, or a human story there, and that these are human beings that are being crushed there. So you and I at least should have sympathy, right, for the human element of that story. And in denying or ignoring our historical reality will not equip you and I to be part of Christ's solutions moving forward. We need to know this. We need to understand this so that we can articulate moving forward. All right? Let me pray. Lord God in heaven, we thank you for again this day. Lord, we pray and ask that you by your Spirit would give us the heart and mind that you would have us to have about these very contentious issues. And that you would help us, Lord, be part of your solution as you indeed are marching on in history to fix the things that are wrong. In Jesus' name, amen.